Hey, welcome to Info Under the Radar, the show where we talk with an expert to simplify everyday ideas, concepts, and subjects that surround us.
Hello, and welcome to Info Under the Radar. I'm your host, Vishwajit.
And I'm Devendra.
Welcome to the Season 2, Episode 10, which is also going to be the final episode of Season 2, where we talked about relationship with money and like all the complexities around it. We talked with Kent Tune, who is a financial advisor, wealth manager. He has more than 2 decades of experience in financial advising, investing, portfolio management, so on and so forth. Before we talk to Kent, maybe we can give you some insights into what we talked about in this episode.
I don't think the topic in itself needs much explanation. However, it's just the nuance with which we tried to cover the topic that's more important. It's very rare that we get to ask ourselves that what is my relationship with money? Because there are two categories of people. One is like, okay, money is not that important for me. And then the other people that money is the most important thing to me. And then that does not go into the granularities of what makes it important or why is it not important if you say that it's not important. So that was the key idea when we thought of this topic. And Kent was a really good guest to come over and help us navigate through the troubled waters of some certain questions, both from a psychological perspective, a little bit of a philosophical perspective, and of course, his depth of experience in financial advising, financial planning, and investment advising. So there are a variety of topics, subtopics, if I may, that we covered within the domain of relationship with money, starting with the very basic question, how does he define his relationship with money? How has it evolved over the age? How does resource abundance, resource scarcity has played a role in it, and so on and so forth?
Yeah, I also like the cultural aspect of money. I mean, there are certain cultures. Every culture, every country has cultures which are kind of made fun of because of their attachment to the money, right? Yeah. Either you are in Germany or in India or the US. Yeah. But like, what are kind of the reasoning behind it? Why certain set of people tend to be so much more attached to like quote unquote money? Well, we are using money loosely. We are more referring to wealth in general. And then we are also looking into like different facets of the personality, how the personality is affecting someone's relationship with the money, why even siblings who might be coming from same parents might have a totally different relationship with money. How, for example, if you grew up poor, that does not mean you are necessarily attached to money, but you might be very generous with money because you have saw certain things growing up, and so on and so forth. So we did not just made it like another investment podcast, but rather we spend a fair bit of time to understand fundamental relationship, individual's relationship with money.
Yeah. And that's what I meant when we talked with him about that money is not just a tool, although it should be looked as one, but for all pragmatic purpose, it's perceived as some sort of carrying some sort of an emotional value with it. And your personality type also determines how you're going to behave with it or how you're going to behave around it. Yeah. So these are some of the things. Then, although we talk about different cultures, there are certain things that are common in every culture, like the age-old advice of investing in property, buying a house, and buying bonds or buying gold.
Yeah.
We also discuss about that. What's the viability of that in the current day and age? Primarily that. And then we must add at this point that although, of course, when we have a guest like that and we wanted to cover the topic holistically, we wanted to cover the idea of what would his advice be to young people who are in their 20s or 30s, have just started earning or have been earning for past couple of years. But this is not a financial advice thing. For the sake of disclaimer, we have to say that. Yeah. And this is just an exchange of opinion that is happening. So take it with a massive grain of salt, if you may. Mm-hmm. And so we did talk about what would he advise in the terms of buying properties, how house is seen not just as another asset, but also as that's something that gives you a sense of security.
Mm-hmm.
So how to think of house and investing in house and property in that regard. And
yeah, talking about like different cultures, which, for example, talk about investing in gold. What does that mean in 2023? Or for example, investing in crypto or things like that. He also gives examples of some of his clients because he's working with clients who vary from having net worth in millions of dollars. So then, of course, he also shares like how his clients coming from different age group or in different background also want different type of investment. And that could also be interesting for our audience who might be looking into maybe more alternate source of wealth development, not just like traditional way of investing in a company. I don't know, which is creating worse like environmental problems. Probably you don't want to invest in it and things like that. So with that, we will start our conversation with Kent. And one last thing, if I just mentioned in the beginning of the episode, this is the 10th and the season finale for season 2. So if you are interested in knowing when is the season 3, what's happening, then stay tuned for the outro towards the end of the episode after our conversation with Kent.
All right. So without further ado, let's talk with Kent now.
Hi, Kent. Welcome to Info Under the Radar. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you. It's good to be here.
So maybe to kickstart our conversation, how do we define our relationship to money? Like, so if I ask you, for example, Kent, how do you define your relationship with money?
Very good question. I would return by saying not enough people ask that same question of themselves. Most people don't really have a definition of what their relationship with money is, which I just kind of follow what societal norms are. They follow what I call scripts, you know, like in a movie, it's handed to them when they're younger. And so me personally, my definition of, or my relationship with money is I use it as a tool to get to places that I want to be rather than becoming a tool for money itself. I'll explain that a little bit. For example, the idea of retirement, you know, that's probably the single largest financial goal that most people have. Maybe it's called different things, but you're saving and investing money for years or decades in the future. And you're envisioning some type of destination where you want to be. And maybe you're sitting at your desk at work or wherever it is, or at home remotely, and you have pictures on the wall of beautiful places that you want to end up. But you're not thinking about what is money doing for me now? I'm living now. So when I define something like retirement, it's a good idea to have a broad definition, and then you can fit that into your own personality, your own life. For example, retirement means doing what I want when I want within reason. So then someone can be retired much sooner. In other words, I'm kind of branching off into a lot of different areas now, but many people are led by the idea that there is one way to think about money, and that is I need to get a lot of it, and I'm going to reach some destination where I don't have to work anymore, and I'm living some type of enchanted life somewhere, whereas really what people want is just to have some choices and some options. So I think I've not answered your question directly, but I don't really have a concrete definition of what money is. It's really just a tool that helps me to live the life that I want to lead. And I want to make sure that I'm careful that I'm not making money a destination. It is rather a tool that helps me to live the life that I want.
Fascinating. Your view essentially reflects that you're keeping some sort of end in your mind. When you talk about retirement, that's essentially the end of your productive years. And people more and more every day are trying to bring those productive work years like very segregated and very earlier than their productive life years. Like people want to retire in their early 40s or late 30s. So your view essentially tries to focus on the fact that, okay, when, at least in your case, when you think of relationship with money, it's keeping that sort of goal in mind that when retirement, the undeniable reality comes, I want to maintain the same life standard that I have or close to that what I had. That's kind of a very mature opinion, one would say, where it's more of a planned thing. Was it always the case with you that you had this in your head, even like 10 years ago or 20 years ago, or has it evolved over time for you?
It's evolved over time. And Devitt, you're, in my mind, you're asking two questions, or you bring up two interesting points.
Mm-hmm.
One is that humans can't help but to have some future idea or future destination in mind. I'm not a psychologist or a scientist, but I believe those types of thoughts come from the frontal lobe of the brain, where that's the part of the brain that is the planning function, but it also is the part of the brain that can create anxiety because we don't know what the future holds exactly. We're uncertain, we're uncomfortable, and money becomes a solution to help us feel more comfortable. So we can dream about what our future is going to be. But that can be a problem. It's kind of like, to put it simply, everyone's living for the end of the day, the end of the week, the vacation, the retirement. It even translates into religion. Life is hell now, but I'll be in heaven one day. And so that can be a real mistake, because I'm not saying the religious ideas are a mistake at all, but what I'm trying to say is that just living for the future removes you from the present. And so that's where there's a lot of conflicts that I can have. I have to reconcile those two things with managing money and helping people plan for the future. I just have to remind my clients that you're living now. You know, should I take this money and invest it for my retirement 20, 30, 40, 50 years from now? Or should I go on that vacation that I've always wanted to do? So you have to kind of balance living now and saving for the future. And I think I didn't answer your question exactly, but when you brought up the idea that people just naturally think about the future, money becomes a large part of that, because it's kind of a solution or maybe a comfort, knowing that, hey, I'm setting aside X amount of money per month. I'm going to get X amount of return on my investment. By the time I reach X age, I will have this amount of money, and now I can really live. But in that case, you're not living now. Mm-hmm. You're just surviving. And so there's a difference between those two. And we're probably opening up a lot of different ideas. And that's the way my brain works.
I think what you're saying is quite interesting. It's also such a broad topic. So I think it's totally understandable that it's very hard to give a clear answer, right? Money as a topic, which is not like, it's not a scientific thing, right? It's just so, it involves so many things. There are emotions involved. Like there is, as we talked about, culture, religion, whatever, there are so many things involved. So everyone bring their own points of view, biasness, whatever you want to call it. So I think it makes sense that you are giving also broader perspective on it, especially you don't only handle your money, which is the case for most of us. We only handle our money, but you have to handle money of a lot of people. And as you said, your relationship with money evolved over time. So I was wondering, like, when the clients come to you, because you have clients from different age groups, right? You might have some clients who are in their 30s, 40s, but there are clients who are working with you for a long time, but now they are in their, 50s, 60s, even older. And I was wondering, how does, let's say, the mindset towards investment differs between different age groups? If I ask my dad, for example, his advice would be very much save for the future, right? Like save for the, money for retirement, save for the money for your kids, marriage, whatever, depending on the culture, country, it can vary a lot, right? And for us, for example, for me, I personally believe more what you were saying. So I was wondering, how do you see the difference in like people who have money in different age groups? How do they want their money to be handled? And how do you navigate this kind of complicated landscape?
Very good question. And you are correct in that, different age groups are naturally going to have different perspectives toward money. It's kind of a generality. Everyone's different. Some of my older clients have a very youthful perspective. Some of my younger clients have traditional values as well. But in general, what I see is, say, the so-called millennial age group, maybe in their 30s. There are ideas that I think are exciting with regard to what a relationship with money is. And this is, again, a generality, but the idea of FIRE, you know, the acronym FIRE, financial independence, retire early. That, I think it is kind of gimmicky, but I like the idea of it because that goes back to the first point that I made where you're thinking more about now. Why does retirement have to be the retirement of my grandparents, where I'm working my entire life? And in the United States, we have, you know, pensions like government funded pensions, Social Security. And so when we talked about definitions early on in the conversation as well, the definition of retirement, for example, is, you know, in the United States, age 65. Where did you come up with that age? Because that's when I can start to earn. We're now at 67, but now that's when I can start to earn the government funded pension, Social Security. Mm-hmm. Whereas with the younger generation, they're beginning to think, I don't want to wait till I'm old. I want to do things now. And that's where the idea of FIRE comes in. I'm not saying that I support that idea, but I like the philosophy behind it. And so some of the younger clients that I have do want to use money now, but also save for the future. An example I'll give is, this is not something that I personally recommend, but an example would be trying to, say, buy real estate or something like that, where I have some clients, for example, in Southern California, they want to buy a home or a vacation place, whether it be out in the desert or the mountains or wherever they want to go. And it's a place for them to get away, but they see it as an investment for the future. And they're trying to do it within a few years, not decades. So to answer your question and go back, there, I do see with younger people the idea with money that I'm more excited about, that where I am now when I'm 53, is that you want to use your money now, but you also want to save and invest for the future. So that does lead a little bit how I recommend investing, because, you know, if you need money in 2 years, you may not want to take a lot of risk with that. So we want to have a balance where we have, you know, money for 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, but also 10, 20, 30 years from now. With the older clients, most of them are more, kind of have the traditional idea of what they need to do with their money. They're already retired in the conventional sense. They're earning the Social Security, maybe a pension from their former employer. And you might be surprised, but a lot of those older clients don't even need their investments. They have sources of income, and they may live a simple lifestyle. And that could bring up another point where they probably thought their whole lives that they had to save a certain amount of money to live, and then their investments become a source of income. And I've had clients who have passed away and they never even used their investments. So that reflects back to the idea, or supports the idea, that maybe you don't need all that money that all the financial gurus are telling you. Maybe you can spend some now, maybe you can live now. So I hope that answers the question.
The thing that came to my mind is that you consult people and you talk to people, how should they deal with their money? So there's a certain sense of objectivity that just by the very virtue of that not being your own money comes with it. However, the very fact that whenever we talk of money, which is essentially debt in any format one would like to think, and when you think of debt, it comes of as, okay, now the second factor I have to think of is risk. and how risk averse am I, right? So when you are dealing with, let's say, some sort of a client, and when you're dealing with personally your own investment, do you see the degree of risk aversion being slightly different by the virtue of objectivity that you have? Or is it, it remains the same that you follow the same principles and you go irrespective of whether it's your money or your clients?
Very good question. There's two levels of thinking. And if I'm understanding your question correctly, you're saying that maybe it's easier for someone to invest money when they're thinking of it objectively because it's someone else's money. Mm-hmm. And then do I think with the same objectivity with my own money? That's your question,
yeah.
Correct?
Yeah.
You're generally right. That's what I believe. I won't tell you, or I can't speak for my clients, but I believe most of them would say, if they thought about it, what is the greatest value or the most valuable aspect of having an advisor? And that is, it separates their own psychology from their money. Because we were saying either earlier, I think it was Jeet who said, you know, their money is an emotion provoking thing. Two of the most dangerous emotions when it comes to money and investing is greed and fear. Fear is the most important, is the most dangerous one, because most human beings have a stronger emotional reaction to a loss than the emotional reaction to a gain. Mm-hmm. For example, they don't celebrate when their investment account is up 10% this year, but they will. They'll be fearful and have a negative reaction much more so if it's negative 10%. And so, yes, it does help. An advisor, again, can be the most valuable aspect is there's a filter between your own money and your psychology. So with my own money, I do think of it. It's impossible to be objective about your own, but I have the fortune of living through, I think it's at least three recessions and three of the worst bear markets in history. So I know that it's cyclical, it comes and goes. Mm. So it's not objectivity that helps me. It's just knowing that these are all natural cycles, the ups and downs of the market. So to go back and answer your question, yes, objectivity does help with investing, because when I'm buying or selling or whatever I'm doing, I'll give you an example. The stock market has been down most of the year. And when the market is weak, is the way I say it, that's a good time to buy, because I know that it's going to resume climbing higher in the future. It always does that. And so I think some of my clients don't want to even know what I'm doing, although I tell them anyway. But separating yourself from the investments can be useful. And we can talk about this too, but it is possible to manage your own money and come up with different methods of separating yourself from it. I'll pause there.
Yeah. No, I had to ask this question because many a times when people are considering whether to consult a financial advisor, or I do not have enough funds for that, how should I deal with my own money? That's one of the things that gets ignored. That's like a latent variable that people seem to ignore, that my objectivity with my money is very questionable. So that was the reason I had to ask this question. And you answered it very clearly and lucidly that, okay, where do we draw the line of, okay, that's my money and that provokes an emotion. And that's the point where I still need to be aware where it goes. But if a third person who's presumably an expert or has more knowledge than me should handle it for me while consulting with me, because that creates a layer of abstraction where it leaves room for more objectivity, whether it's a bull market or a bear market, because market always works on the assumption of optimism, which I don't know how that works, but it so far has worked out really well.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm thinking of a client that I just exchanged a few emails with this week. He's older, but he's still working. He wants to retire and say 5 years. Mm-hmm. And I asked him how he felt about, you know, the market, how things are going. And he said, half of me wants to pull the money out of the market and half of me wants to continue with our program and what we're doing. But I totally understood that. And my response was that, they, like I just said a few minutes ago, stock markets are cyclical. You will see, it may be a handful of months or maybe even a year or so, your balances will be higher. And sticking with our plan is going to produce results. And so, yeah, they're managing money is also managing emotions. And to extend the point about using an advisor, there is a separation from the potentially damaging emotions and the money. Now, some personality types can work well with managing their own money. This is not an advertisement for everyone to go out there and get an investment advisor. But knowing yourself, I mean, this could be another topic. Self-knowledge is one of the highest virtues of managing money well. If you know that you're just going to panic and you're just going to want to sell every time the market falls, either you need to change your investment strategy or you need to just not look at it. But some people have no problem with the ups and downs of the market. Some people get excited when the market is down because they're buying more. Mm-hmm. So yes, I think we're venturing off into another topic as well. Right. With that.
Actually, but that's the topic I wanted to talk about. So actually it's a perfect transition. So because we were going into the topics of investment more and more, and I think we will talk further about it, but I think one of the fundamental questions we had why this episode is happening was, why do we act a certain way with our money anyways, right? That's something we also talked earlier offline before as well with you, Kent. And I think that is a very interesting one for a lot of people. When I was talking about this episode also with friends, and everyone has this very unique sort of experience with money, right? And I wanted to go a little bit in detail with your experience, like how maybe you have some ideas or theories behind it. Why do people act certain way, right? Some people, for just as an example, like every cent, every dollar, every euro matters. Others, not so much. For some, they are very risk averse. Others, not so much. And so on and so forth. So first of all, I wanted to know your like just general idea, like based on your experiences working with different people and just on your own as well. What do you think is like, what are some of the key factors which influence our relationship with money? How do we see it and how we treat it, irrespective of however money we have? But the general nature remains the same, right? Even if you became a millionaire, some people still keep and count on every cent. And some people who don't even have a lot of money, but they don't care. And when they have it, they still don't care. And I wonder, what are some of the key factors which defines that?
Very good question. I'll start this time with a simple answer and then maybe venture off from that. But from my perspective, my experience, it's really two primary factors that influence the way people look at money, how they feel about it. One is their personality. That's something that is irreversible. If we use an analogy with a computer, that's hardwiring. That's the hardware that's unchangeable. The other aspect would be, to continue on that analogy, would be the software, which is changeable, which is, you know, environmental, the way you were raised, your parents, they're handing you things. Again, I use the word script, kind of like in a movie. It's not explicitly saying you have to be this way with money, although some parents do that. Mm-hmm. For example, you can go through experiences that change your outlook on money, or if you're a child and you're watching your parents, they're stressed out about it, they don't have enough. And it seems as if this thing called money is the answer to problems. So there's some people that have that idea. And I think offline, we were talking about this as well. Sometimes someone might think, well, my parents always struggle with money and I'm going to make sure that I don't. Mm-hmm. So there's almost an infinite combination of factors that can come in. But I would say that two primary factors that influence the way people see money and the way they feel about it is their personality type and environmental, which would be what they saw, what they experienced as a child. And I'll give you one example I've seen. For example, my wife, I mean, her mother didn't have enough. She was raised by a single mom. She rarely had enough money to maybe just put food on the table, and that was about it. So there's an idea of scarcity. Mm-hmm. So there, some people have a scarce perspective on money where there's not enough. There's never enough. Mm. Even if you do have enough, you still don't feel like you do. So you're constantly putting money aside and you're not wanting to spend. Some people have the opposite. Money is abundant. Money is everywhere. Even if you don't have much, you're thinking, it's going to come to me. I'm not worried about it. Mm-hmm. So those are just examples. One is the personality type, which is unchangeable. The other is the environmental, which is kind of taught or learned. Mm-hmm. And this could be another topic, but the latter environmental, the aspect that's taught or learned, can be changed with new learning. It can take some time, but at least that part is changeable.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's a very interesting one, because when you said that, I almost was thinking then maybe the part of personality might be even stronger than of the environment, because, and of course, that's what you even said, that it's hardware. And I wonder, because like you gave the example of your wife, I think I gave you my example. Like growing up, my parents had a lot of discussions over money. They were not doing the greatest, and financial tension was always present in my house. And the natural reaction to people is that, oh, then you must be very careful with the money, which I'm not always. And actually it's for me, it's all almost opposite of it, where I really care about experiencing things. I'm not necessarily, of course, I do have this idea of money will eventually come. And some of it also comes from my skill, the studies, and, you know, it's a work experience, confidence, but it's also thus was there even when I was in high school. Like fundamentally, there was this idea that money will kind of come and I have to work towards it. Luckily, it also worked where I worked towards it. So it even becomes stronger. I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing, but I think it's very interesting that I know some people who are in exact same situation as me, and they have really, like, they care about each and every cent. And for me, it's completely opposite, as if I grew up with a lot, which I did not. And right. To me, it becomes very interesting that then it's the environment becomes even less important. It has a definite impact, but what is hardwired inside you, in my case, maybe this, the abundant kind of mindset, maybe even have a stronger impact. I don't know. Just a thought.
I think you are right. I think that the idea that money's abundant or scarce can be something that's part of the personality, and it can be much stronger than the environment. I'm sure anyone listening can just imagine, you know, especially looking at children, and it does help to have the right parents, but some children can be poor and they have no idea that they're poor. Mm-hmm. They're happy. Mm-hmm. They just, all they need is a ball and then go outside and play. Right. And they don't even realize that they're poor. Whereas there are some cases where it could be the opposite. Their money is literally abundant. There's money everywhere. The family is wealthy, but the child doesn't know that they're wealthy. Mm-hmm. So I think that we could be the environmental part in that regard. The example is the parents. But you are right. The hardwiring, the personality can create that idea of abundance or scarcity. So it's not always the environment that creates that. So yeah, it's a complex kind of.
Yeah, I mean, sure, combination. I'm sure it's combination, right? It's like if you have it abundant, and then maybe with my personality type, I might have reacted differently if I grew up in a different environment. But yeah, it's hard to answer.
So we just talked about the idea of like this personality being a culmination and combination of a variety of stuff. And we were talking about the socio-economic or socio-cultural environment around it. I want to take it like, I want to zoom out of it a little bit, that while growing up, one of the most common advices that I used to receive in investment was either invest in gold, invest in bonds, or buy property. Now, one of them you have already objected to, which is that buying property might not be like not in the fashion that many people are buying in some part of like California and just thinking as holiday home. Gold is really questionable now. I'm not sure if it can even defeat inflation at the moment in any country. I'm not sure about the Middle Eastern parts. The only one that I've read a bit about is then the bonds. But then let's come back to the one where you already had an opinion. So you said that you wouldn't recommend buying property as a source of investment. Would you not recommend that for anyone? Or is there an age group you wouldn't recommend it for? Or there are certain other conditions under which you would recommend or would not?
Very good question. I'll start with the real estate part. What I was thinking and what I meant was it's not something that I personally would invest in. I think a real estate can be a great investment. I think that a lot of people, especially younger people, are kind of led by ideas and thinking and what they've read or heard. Same thing goes with the gold and the bonds and all that. That's what you were taught when you were younger. Now, real estate can be a good investment, both in the aspect of price appreciation. You know, the asset is growing. In most cases, real estate appreciates, you know, it goes up in value over time. It can go down in value, but usually not. So over time, you know, it should average about 3 to 5% price appreciation. But what most people like about real estate is, you know, the passive income. I'm getting paid money, you know, I'm getting paid money just to have this asset. I'm renting out my property. I'm getting paid every month. There's also other aspects. I'm a landlord now. I own a property. Do I want to be called in the middle of the night when the toilet breaks and all the plumbing is spewing water everywhere? Well, if I don't want to do that, then I have to hire a property management company to do that for me. So there's also other costs. There's maintenance, there's taxes. I don't like all those costs. I don't like being attached to a physical thing that I have to manage. I like just opening my laptop and going on to the markets and buying and selling stocks. It's much easier. Also, let's go ahead and throw in gold and bonds. The rate of return for stocks outperforms all those assets over time. Gold any person would be fortunate to get even the rate of inflation, the average rate of inflation. You know, inflation is high now, but gold typically remains about the rate of inflation or below. There are short periods of time where it can perform. Bonds are the same. In general, you're going to earn maybe 3 to 5% growth over time, and that includes the price appreciation and the yield that you're receiving. Stocks, 8 to 10% on average over time. So I'm getting twice the return with stocks. It's also something that I understand, which is another topic is, you know, never invest in something you don't understand. Mm-hmm. If you don't understand it, you're probably investing in it because someone told you to, or, you know, the idea of a script, you know, you're handed these thoughts. Where do they come from? Why do I think that gold or bonds is a good investment? Why did I put money into cryptocurrency? Because someone told you to.
Yeah.
You didn't think about it, or you didn't understand it first.
Right.
That's another topic. I mean, right now, cryptocurrency is getting a lot of bad press. You know, the the company FTX.
Mm-hmm.
They use celebrities, you know, to advertise their product. And so, hey, if this celebrity is buying cryptocurrency, then I should too.
Mm-hmm.
No, that's the worst reason in the world to do it, because some advertisement told you to do it. But anyway, back to the point. It's interesting, Dev, that you mentioned, you know, different investments that you thought about maybe when you were younger. I would say that with regard to real estate or any of those investments, I'm not saying they're a bad idea, but make sure that you understand it and you're investing in those things because mm-hmm. it's suitable for you and it's going to help you reach your goals. Mm-hmm. If you're trying to grow money over time, bonds and gold are not going to get you there, but as part of a diversified portfolio, gold and bonds generally have a low correlation with stocks. And so if you're trying to put money together in one investment portfolio, they can absolutely play a role in it, but maybe not put all your money there.
So I wanted to ask more about the property part. I have my own kind of strong opinions on it over time that more often than not, it does not necessarily make sense to invest in properties, especially in like expensive big cities. And I wanted to know with someone like you who is doing this for a job to who is advising people, what do you think about not necessarily maybe from your client's perspective, some of them do have significant amount of money. So they have different type of luxury where they can invest. But let's say, what would you advise to younger people like, you know, us who are in their 20s or people early 30s, you know, people who started working for a few years. And the first thing I think and I found this irrespective of culture, and we have so many divisions in every culture, but one thing, every culture agrees on: buy property, buy real estate. I have not met anyone from any country where they have not been told that, right? Does not matter where you come from. And you made so many good points that, okay, people just think, oh, it will give the passive income, but it comes with a lot of cost, right? For, like if I think about someone who's having a job, if I want to buy a property, I mean, the only way I can do it is by taking a loan, right? On top of that, I need to have money to show it to the bank, to give it to the lawyer. There is a lot of cost involved. Then I have a loan of 30, 40, 25, 30, whatever number of years, right? Then I have to consider if I'm living in a city, like we live in Munich. I'm not sure if you know, but Munich has been always in the top three most expensive places to buy properties, not in Europe, not in Germany, in the world, like in terms of the percentage change. Talk about the United States. I mean, what if you live in the New York City or Los Angeles or San Francisco? Properties are insanely expensive, right? How does that even make sense then to go into this much risk? I don't know if it's risk, but or to get the reward when we are old to pay 25, 30 years of loan. And someone who has taken loan, there is a pressure of paying it off. I know that. I had an education loan. How much of that is really worth it? And if this advice is one of those like tales which are just passed it on generations without people questioning it, because there are a lot of psychological aspects of it as well. And is that the driving factor, the psychological factor part? Oh, there is a sense of security. Does not matter what happens with the market. You still have a roof on your head, et cetera, et cetera. And I was wondering how much truth to is that is, and how do you recommend people like us who are, as I said, in their early career to look towards investment in something like a property, which everyone is supposed to do?
Right. There's so many different, you know, ideas and questions in there that I can address. What I would say first is, again, going back to understanding what you are investing in, what is the cost? And there's more than one cost involved. For example, with real estate, you mentioned the loan. Okay, you're going to have loans cost even more now because of inflation that causes interest rates to go up. I was very fortunate to refinance my mortgage a few years ago, and the interest rate is 2 3/8, or you know, 2.375%. My mortgage on my home is less than the average rent in the United States now, and my property value has doubled over the last, say, 5 to 7 years. Mm-hmm. But I'm just fortunate. I didn't plan that. It's not an investment. Mm-hmm. With rentals or investment property, you do have to look at all those costs. I have to borrow money, like you said, get a loan. What's the cost of the loan? What's the cost of the taxes? What's the cost of the maintenance on average? You don't know that for sure, but you have to kind of average it out. If it's an older property, you have to factor in that the maintenance will probably be higher. And so you have to think about all those costs and then what is my net return? What's my return after those costs? That's why I like stocks much more. I mean, over the last couple of years, most brokerage companies have offered commission-free trading. So it's not absolutely free, but it's extremely low cost. And I like that. I like simplicity. I like higher return. I like low cost. I like low maintenance. So you're right. So when you're thinking about an investment, whether it's real estate or anything, understand it first. Understand how price can move over time, what the cost is. And to that point, I have clients in Los Angeles who own real estate. Some of them work in the real estate industry. Mm. And if you want to get into real estate, of course, do some thinking first, but maybe don't think too much because the values do go up. Speaking of the expensive properties in Los Angeles, for example, I have clients who thought, wow, I thought that, a 1500 square foot apartment for $500,000 was really expensive 5 years ago, but now it's worth $1 million. Mm-hmm. If I had only invested back then, I would have doubled my money. And so sometimes you have to just think it's expensive. It's costing me a lot. It's a large loan. But if the appreciation potential is there, then listen to your future self. Mm. Go ahead and buy. Don't worry about it. Mm. But you have to have time as well. Don't expect to get a large return in just a couple of years. You have to be willing to hold it. So like I said, there's many different factors to think about. Just know that you understand the asset that you're buying. And what do I mean by that? What's an expected reasonable growth rate, a rate of return over time? And what's the cost? Then you subtract the costs out. What's my net return? What am I getting after those costs?
Like the foundational principle here, one of the things that we started with was that the pressure of having a debt on you, the pressure of taking a loan. Now, that is one of the things that is common for like majority of the masses, except for a rare few who we would consider super rich, like multimillionaires or maybe billionaires. They probably see debt and loan very differently. How do you think their relationship with money is in general, if you have studied about it or if you have dealt with some of those maybe? And why is it that they don't see loan the way like a regular 9-to-5 worker would?
Very good question. In the finance world, debt is referred to as leverage. Okay? Mm-hmm. If you think about what leverage can do, imagine a large boulder, a large rock that is seemingly immovable by your own hands. If you place a lever under it, say a strong steel rod or something, and then there's the fulcrum that you put underneath it, and you move the rock with the lever because you're given leverage to do it. You couldn't move that rock if you didn't have the leverage, right? And so that's what debt does. Debt allows you to move something that you couldn't normally move on your own. So in this case, you're buying something that you wouldn't normally be able to buy. And so when I look at debt or leverage, I'm looking at, okay, the cost, right? So what is the cost? The interest rate. What are you paying in interest? So the simple way to look at that is, okay, what is the interest rate and what's my expected rate of return? So I think to answer your question, business owners and maybe wealthier people who don't mind it, and maybe some of them even like it because they're able to get a higher rate of return than their interest rate. For example, if I can borrow money at 5% and I think I can earn 10, then I'm going to borrow all I can because I'm going to get a higher rate of return than the interest rate. So I'm making money. And so that's how businesses can grow. That's how, you know, everyday people can buy a house and it grows over time and it makes more sense than renting over time. And so to go back and answer your question in a simple way, debt is leverage. You're able to do more with it than you could on your own. Just be cautious and conscious about the interest rate that you're paying and don't be afraid of it. Mm-hmm. If your expected rate of return is higher than the interest rate you're paying and other costs factored in, then it can be a worthwhile investment.
I think that's like the key thing with many people who do not like to read about finance or personal finance or money miss, I guess. It's just the way that they treat the, like the analogical boulder that you mentioned, that the people who understand it would find a fulcrum, put a pivot and push it, and other people would just end up being Sisyphus trying to push the boulder up the mountain hill for the rest of their life.
I mean, that's an interesting point. I think I was wondering, like, because this kind of adds up to like the next question, which I wanted to ask, which was like, a lot of people don't necessarily grow up with generational wealth, right? When I say generational wealth, I'm talking about like passed on wealth, which is from generation to generation, right? Like I definitely did not grow up with it. They did not grow up with it. And I was wondering what are like fundamentals could people use or think about when we consider amassing generational wealth. I think I'm asking you because, of course, you are a wealth advisor, but I think you are also in unique, you comes also from a unique culture of United States where that's a really big thing, right? Like I mean, the fundamental, don't want to make it about America, but it's the fundamental of a nation of United States is the American dream, which is basically about like kind of the stories of rags to riches. And of course, more often than not, it might not work. And we see there are very downsides of it. Don't want to go on that. But the cases where it does work, I was wondering what are some of the fundamentals which does help with it besides, you know, getting born with it, of course, which is the easiest way possible.
Right, good question. So you're talking about generational wealth and maybe what impact that might have either way. And then, of course, we're factoring in what we're talking about, what we were talking about earlier with personality types and how you're raised and all those type things. What comes to mind is a book that I read years ago. I think it's called The Millionaire Next Door. But the idea of it is the authors of the book, I think it's co-authored. I don't remember their names. But anyway, they studied millionaires. And they wanted to know what their feelings were about it, what thoughts were. And what was interesting to me about that is that the self-made millionaires, the ones who were their rags to riches stories, the ones that were, and these were mostly United States citizens, the ones who had the healthiest outlook on money were immigrants who came to America. They had nothing. They started a business or had an idea and they grew their wealth. Now, the mistake that they can make though, is that when they have children, and you're talking about generational wealth, and they want their children so much to have what they did not have.
Yeah.
And so they don't mean to do this, but they hand their money, a lot of money to their kids, and they don't learn the same lesson that they did, is that when you don't have much, there, I guess you could say there's more of an appreciation for receiving it. And you're more careful with it and you learn more how to manage along the way. You make mistakes, you have successes. And so when people are just handed money and they didn't earn it, They don't appreciate the value of money. For example, when my children were younger, I have two boys, one's 18, one's 21 now. But when they were younger, I didn't just give them money for anything. They had to do something for it first. Yeah, it wasn't, hey, dad, can I have $20? Well, you didn't earn it. Go outside and mow the lawn and, you know, or, you know, pick up some trash and fold your clothes, and then maybe I'll give you some money for it. So generational wealth is interesting in regards to, again, it comes down to parenting. If you're just handed money for no reason, you're not learning, appreciating the value of it. Whereas the opposite, the stories of the self-made millionaires who were immigrants that came to America, or they were just already citizens and they just grew up poor and they learned how to make their own money, they appreciate it more. So their relationship with it is different.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking also more in terms of actionable items is like, so does it then comes down to basically then, I mean, traditionally we see like people who are rich, or at least let's say the known people who are wealthier, I should use the word wealthier, maybe it's better than rich. They tend to either come from families who owns businesses or industries or whatever, or they themselves do it, right? I think the book you referred to, I think I've also read it. And there are also stories of just people doing regular jobs and they don't even appear they are millionaires. But it's right. Comes down to the investment they do and the lifestyle they live. And I was wondering if you also have any thoughts on that and how realistic it is actually, especially for the millennial Gen Z generation where our attention span is low. We want fast, everything fast, be it fast videos on TikTok or be it faster rate of returns. Like, does something like that still applies, or it still, you truly believe that it comes down to actually owning, you know, businesses and things like that is the most realistic way to have actually long-term wealth?
Good questions. The word that comes to mind there is paradox, where, you know, there's two things happening at the same time that can be true, where, you know, getting rich fast can also turn you poor fast. In other words, if you want, I'll think of an example. Okay, I had a prospective client who didn't become a client, and the reason why is because she said, I want to average a rate of return of 15% for 10 years. That is possible, but I told her, I said, we have to take some pretty high risk to get that. And if you're trying to aim for 15, you'll probably end up with 5. And the reason why is because you have to take more risk than is necessary, or I should say above optimal or too much risk. There is such thing as too much risk. And so another point that comes to mind is the idea of getting rich slowly, or there's a saying, and that we have that maybe you do as well. If you want to double your money, then take your dollar and fold it in half and put it in your pocket. Mm-hmm. And so time does move very quickly. And so I don't want to sound negative here, but 20 years will go by in a heartbeat. So if you're just investing and getting a reasonable rate of return, you're going to double your money every 5 to 7 years, and you just automate your investments, put your have a plan, and stick to it, and you will be wealthy later. Now, does that mean don't chase after the higher returns now? Not really, but expecting to get rich quickly or trying to do it can also turn into losing your money as well. So that's the paradox, is that taking too much risk is going to turn your plan into the opposite of what you wanted. Whereas if you're cautious and careful, you can get to the point where you want to reach.
Fascinating. Like that, in a sense, it's, if you're coming back to where we started, in the sense of keeping the end in mind while knowing that there are no get rich quick schemes involved. Like it's essentially boils down to compounding at the end of the day and compounding and consistency. What I then would like to ask is, what does a healthy relationship with money look like to you?
What is a healthy relationship with money? I just have to just, what comes to mind first is a healthy relationship with money is someone who doesn't think about it often. Because when you're thinking about it too much, then it's leading other aspects of your life. I think a healthy relationship with money is someone who sees it as a tool that can be used. It's a means to an end, but it is not an end in itself. It's not a destination. I've used that word destination two or three times in this conversation. And I've used the word tool, right? Money is a tool. It's something that can help you carve a path to your destination, but it is not the destination itself. So people who have a healthy relationship with money are people who are not living for it. They're living for something else, and which is, you know, their purpose. Why do they wake up in the morning? Hopefully your reason for getting up in the morning is not how much money can I make today? Now, there are some people who can have healthy life and a healthy perspective toward money who do want to make more. Some people see money as just a symbol of progress or symbol of success. They don't really care about the money. They just, I don't know why, but the first thing that comes to mind is athletes, right? Some of the high paid athletes, they're making millions. You know, we're in the middle of the World Cup now. Some of those football players, or we call it soccer, are the highest paid athletes in the world. You know, they maybe 10 million a year or 20 million a year. But a lot of them, and when you listen to them talk, they're not thinking about money. And when they renegotiate a contract, they want to be the highest paid athlete on their team, or maybe the highest paid athlete in the world. But they're using it as a measuring mark for their success. Mm-hmm. I want to make more than this guy next to me. Right. Why? Not because I want more money, but because I want proof that I'm better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I'm venturing off into another topic once again, but what is a healthy outlook on money? Someone who doesn't live for it, and they're using money as a tool. They're using money as a means to achieve goals that are their higher purpose. Their higher purpose is not money itself. The money is helping to serve their higher purpose.
I think that's a very good answer. And I think that kind of also sums up the conversation we had, like the difference, like both zoomed in and zoomed out views we had, how we treat money versus how actually we should use money. So thanks a lot for your time. I think it was a lovely conversation. I think this answers kind of sums it up. And I think we think you answered all of our questions, which we wanted to ask. So thanks once again to come here and take your time early morning, Kent.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed the conversation, and maybe we can do it again sometime.
Thank you guys for listening so far. And not just this episode, but the past two seasons or one season or however many episodes that you have been listening to. We really appreciate your comments and suggestions that you have sent to us via social media, via personal messages and DM. Really grateful for that. So you're here to know when the season 3 is coming out or what are the plans moving forward. This is the right place. This is where we discuss all of that, the secret sauce that we have, which isn't much. There's no secret sauce to things. It's always the topics that interest us will be a part of this podcast. And that's the primary theme that remains. One of the things that will change moving forward is that this would be my last season for the time being. I would not be co-hosting it for the near future because of other priorities and other things that I wish to focus upon. My academics, my jobs, and other interests that I have being parts and parcel of that. So that would be one change that you'll see. But other than that, the nature of the topic and everything would be probably centralized around curiosity. Vishwajit will take a call on that, apparently, about what his curiosity dictates. But I'm guessing that would be, I'm assuming that would be the key idea behind how this podcast goes forward. When will it be there? No idea, because it requires planning once one of the person goes out. So no pressure on him so far. But I'll probably be around. In spirit, I guess, if that matters. But yeah, did I miss something?
No, I mean, I think in general, I would just say that I think we have been doing it for 2 years, actually. Yeah. I think we started the discussion exactly in 2020, like beginning, very early 2020, I think. 2021.
Yeah.
So I think some might even say it's one of those pandemic side projects. Regarding the next season, my idea would be to at least have another season where I see how it is if just one of us do it, in this case me, if we are still able to bring the same value, it's even feasible, considering I also have a full-time job, mm-hmm. considering the amount of work goes into it, which is a lot, especially if you're working on top. So yeah, let's see. But for now, definitely what I can say is that I'm planning to do at least the next season, mm-hmm. hopefully more, never know. And I don't want to share like specific ideas. I have some, but the most important part is that, of course, you please keep following us on social media and on Instagram.
Yeah, your feedback has more value than before now. If you're listening to us, because right now, see, when there are two people, or in the season two, we also had an intern, so there were three people, the discussions in these, when ideas bounce off, then the feedback loop is pretty instant in those meetings. Mm-hmm. However, when it boils down to one person steering the entire ship, then the feedback from you becomes primarily the most important thing. So then moving forward, although it's a very stereotypical thing to say that, okay, keep following us, keep giving us the reviews, but I mean it when I say it from an objective perspective, that it would be the founding stone of how season three unfolds, or any the further season unfolds in that regard, that how much feedback are you able to give, not just sharing, liking, that's okay, that's great, but constructive feedback is something that would help Vishwajit apparently quite a lot, and the podcast quite a lot. So there's been a lot of work that has gone into it, and a lot of work has gone into it.
I think of course lately we have been pretty irregular. Keeping that aside, for the most part, let's say at least for 1.5 seasons out of two, I would say we were pretty regular. Mm-hmm. If not once a week, at least 2 times a month we came. And when you have to do that on top of all the responsibilities,
yeah,
we are not looking for pity marks here, but like that's just a fact. So I definitely think that going forward, whenever I do it, it will not be like weekly podcast, probably bi-weekly, something along those lines, considering the work.
Once in 2 weeks.
Yeah, once in 2 weeks, basically, not like 2 times a week. But as I said, like we keep informing you, because that is something I have to think about as well. I don't have concrete plans how I want to do it, when I want to do it. One thing is for sure, that I will do it. That part is clear. And but more details on that very soon. So stay tuned, keep following us on Instagram, Twitter, whatever. And if you are one of the personal friends who have been supporting us, then you will anyways hear about it as well, which most of the listeners are at this point. But before we go, I would say like thanks a lot to Dev, because I don't think I would have started it probably just by myself. I think it's like one of those creative endeavors which works pretty well, especially for someone like me, when you are bouncing off each other, where you are kind of getting energy out of each other. And in some ways we have very similar ways of looking at things, but in other ways very different. So I think that was also the one of the fun parts, sometimes hard part, but mostly fun part of working together. So thanks a lot for all the work you put in.
Thank you at the same time as well, for putting the work in a common project as well. The feeling stands mutual. And I wish we had like this, video recording. So when we were planning the episode of like when we plan how the questions could be, I don't know, like we've never shared this, like what goes on behind the screen where just to give a brief idea of how the pipeline overall works so that people get a view into that. Why do we say it's a lot of work? Because first we find the guest, then we schedule an initial meeting, which is 30 to 45 minutes long, where we try to probe our guest and see if that would be the right guest. And trust us, even though we are not like massively big million followers podcast, we have episodes which were completely recorded and we never released it. We have guests who are very credible and we never really went forward them after the initial meeting. It's not about we being very nosy or being arrogant, but that meeting is very foundational. It's very hard to like reach that stage. Once that stage is reached, then the second challenge is always that, what exactly do we individually think of the topic, and then which part of that will come, which is, of course, there's a lot of pushing and pulling going on when we are, okay, we want this question to be there. Do we want that or not? So these are the recordings I wish we had, but of course, no one really thinks that these recordings would be of any use to anyone. Also, recording all of that is a fairly difficult task. Now I see why there are like so less good documentaries. So part and parcel. So that goes, and then there's an entire sketching of that. And we also had an intern in season two. I would like to thank him on record for that, for all his work. Arnab, if you're listening, thank you for all the work that you did on social media. It was really good. And so so then managing that and all of that. So there was we're not saying it's pretty much, but we're saying that every episode that comes out, even though it's easy when you hear the final product to give it a grade out of 10 that, okay, that was just a 5 on 10 or 6 on 10. But the effort is always close to like 8 or 9 on 10, if not 10.
And then we were really harsh on ourselves. Like, I don't think, like I can say for both of us, I think it, like we would be really, when people said they are their harshest critic, at least for this podcast, we really were. Like, I think it's very hard to like, when friends ask, oh, you are doing this, and we are like, yeah, okay, but we are still not happy. And maybe I think looking back at it, some things we did were actually good, and I think some of the topics were meaningful.
With the exception of one guest in season two, every guest was a cold email guest. So except for one that was storytelling, Mel, other than that, we knew none of the guests.
And when we are talking about cold emailing, it's like reaching out to like 10 up to 12 people sometimes, and basically getting not even responded back from them, because basically they will not care who the hell are these two random dudes.
So I still hold a grudge against Professor Huberman for not replying to my tweet on Twitter, but if you do that, I'll will do a special episode if you come back. But nonetheless, jokes apart, so that's like the pipeline. If anyone of you is ever thinking of going for making your own podcast, because of course, why not, right? So then you should keep in mind that the final product is 1 hour, but I guess we did an estimate that, and combined 25 to 30 hours of work goes into publishing one, including editing and everything, blah, blah, blah. So, but that's the fun part of it once the product is out. And then people are usually more generous than at least what I am to what my work is. The moment I listen to it, I'm the least generous person. Like, these are the nitty-gritties. And we have notes and everywhere where we took chances in editing. So once I would edit, then Vishwajit has to be as brutally honest as is possible. That timeline, like he has to give me the timeline that 37:08, 37:08, there was an extra that we don't need. And we have this for every episode, like it's a written format and everything. So it does take a work, but this is not to gain some sympathy points at this point, right? You do realize we're saying this just to give you a look into what happens behind the stage, and to give you an idea that, okay, this is what the process looks like. So if you like the final result, even if you like one episode, the process was same for all of them. the fact of the matter is that you resonated with one of that, but the work went was all in that. And that's the part of the fun process where we both approach it in a very different fashion, but towards the same goal. And that's the idea of like a combined creative endeavor. So
yeah, I think the one thing which I would say, which might not necessarily have to do with podcasts, but rather like working with someone, especially with a friend, is like you learn a lot about yourself. And I think that's what we did a lot, because I think if you would have started it separately and I would have started separately, we would have just focused a lot on craft. But I think with this also, of course, managing the intern, there was different learning, but I suppose with each other, I think we learned a lot about ourselves and how we work in a creative setting or in general, like, and it's very different, by the way, like in a work culture. I mean, I work in a company as a product manager. Most of my job is literally interacting with a lot of other people, but it's very different. Like the learnings I did in podcast in this closed space was very different. Surprisingly, I did not learn those things at work. Like now I am not surprised and I understand why it was that, but you know, that was not one thing I thought I would get out of this.
This is fascinating, because what you mentioned is it's more of, you can think of it in many other ways, but knowing a person in different capacities is what is highlighted when you change the scope of work from a friendly context to what when you're talking in a more friendly context, the subject is between the two people. That is, it's either about the person you're talking to or the person who's talking about, and that's the subject, and that is confined boundaries between two people. And at the end of the day, that's more manageable, because there's just an opinion on the table. But when you're working towards something that belongs to both of you, but at the same time is outside of the scope of any of yours expertise, then your basic core work personality comes out. That's how you approach any problem statement, which is a rather unsaid thing in regular conversation. Why would you talk to your friend about these things? So that's one of the things, like if you want to take a key takeaway of working with a friend, that's one thing that you should know, that doesn't matter how much you plan, a different aspect of one's personality will come out in the way, not because of someone, other person's like intentional show of that personality, but it's something that the person wouldn't even know themselves, and that's how it would come out. It's also the level of comfort is different when you're already friends. And then that comes out in a very different color. I'm not saying it to put a bad light on it, but I'm just saying that that's a very different experience that you should keep in mind if you're working with friend in financial capacity, in a creative capacity, in any capacity. And that's a learning that you should keep in mind. You'll have which is great fun in hindsight.
Having said that, I mean, we don't want to give an impression. That's why Dave is not gonna work, because we hated each other. Absolutely not. But we just wanted to highlight that, like, even if 5 people listen to the episode, the learnings we did in the last 2 years, especially in the last season, because the first season was very much like a lot of this new project energy. But in the season 2, reality hits you and the life hits you. And like a lot of stuff was going on in individual personal lives. So like some of the very hard things. So on top of doing that, on top of your job, then you really get tested, I think. But like, no regrets. So yeah, I don't know, Dave, if you have something else to add.
No, that's all. That's me signing off.
Okay. So yeah, thanks again. And I'm sure if I when I do season 3, you might hear Dave at some point. I will try to get him.
If I can contribute any capacity, you'll hear my voice again.
I mean, it's pretty good for you, because you don't have to edit. I just get you. You do the fun part of actually talking and recording. So that sounds pretty dope. But
tempting.
Well, then thanks once again for listening to this episode in season 2. Thanks to all the guests of season 2, including Kent, who was our latest guest. And see you guys very soon.
Bye.